Hello and welcome to Required Reading.
Hello.
I'm Erin Bowles. I'm your host. I'm an actor, writer, and comedian. And our guest today, he's a writer, podcaster, not really comedy, but kind of comedy adjacent. You may know him from his podcasts, Gilmore Guys or Good Christian Fun. It's Kevin T. Porter. Hello.
Wow, we're here. We did it. And my dog did not perk up at all when I yelled in the room.
Give him
But
something.
thank you so much for having me. I feel like comedy adjacent is like an under promise over deliver thing, hopefully. It's like when you mark maybe for an RSVP, and then when you show up, people are like, wow, it's good to see you.
Our book today from 1989 by Lewis Sacker is Wayside School is Falling Down, sequel to the 1978 Sideways Stories from Wayside School.
What
Also,
happened in 1989?
oh, well, Taylor, of course.
Well,
But
yeah.
also.
But also, Kevin T. Porter happened in 1989.
Wow.
I have more of a claim to the year than Taylor does. She was there for the last 3 weeks of
That's
it.
true. Wow. You're the same age as Seinfeld and the Exxon Valdez spill.
Wow. I mean, that's kind of the holy trinity of pop culture events, right? All those like ducks covered in black tar and the premiere of the Seinfeld Chronicles, as it was called when it came on, and then
Wow.
me as well.
And the fall of the Berlin Wall. That was 89.
Man, when was that speech given when he was like, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall? That'd be curious, like what trimester I was in at the time.
We can find this out.
Yeah.
So it seems like that speech was 2 years before. It was
Oh.
87.
I wasn't even a twinkle in anyone's eye at that
Not yet,
point.
buddy.
Damn. I thought like maybe Ronald Reagan sort of was like, that's when my mom's water broke and she went into labor. And so that's why I'm like an incredibly conservative man that holds a lot of those same values to this day. Cause Reagan and I, maybe we're like astrologically compatible or whatever. Maybe we're like sun, moon, rising house. Can you tell I know a lot about astrology and I'm invested in it at the same time?
Can.
Thank you.
What's wild is my I have a I know the Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall, not from the actual event, but because my mom is a Soviet Union political scientist who loves
Whoa.
the comic strip Pearls Before Swine.
I
So
remember Pearls Before Swine, yeah.
we have a framed comic strip that's a joke about Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall that I can't explain to you. It's something about
Don't
like a
try.
cash register, but it's very prominently displayed in my parents' house.
Wow. And that'll be why you feel this kind of intimate connection with Ronald Reagan yourself. This is a podcast where we talk about why we feel connected to Ronald Reagan, right?
Also in Simi Valley at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library.
I've been there. I went there like 10 years ago, 10 or 11 years ago. Went on that Air Force One replica or the real thing, whichever one it was.
They have a some sort of like Star Wars exhibit right now.
Remember when Ronald Reagan was in Star Wars? Mr. Vader, tear down this star. Speaking of film, also in 1989, I was just poking
Yeah.
around. When Harry Met Sally, a movie that the first time I watched it 9 years ago, I was like, it's okay. And then I watched it last year. I was like, this is the best movie ever made.
Exactly.
Do the Right Thing, The Little Mermaid kicking off the Disney Renaissance, Tim Burton's Batman, and Twin Peaks, the pilot for that. Came out in 1989.
Wow.
So
Yeah.
just something to think about. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, also a formative text.
Man, I love that thing where you find out that's like put in your birthday and will tell you what was number one in the box office the day you were born.
Oh yeah.
Mine
Well,
was
I'll
Flubber.
my I share yours was Flubber.
Of course.
Whoa.
And then like the day after I was born, Titanic came out, which changed everything. But Flubber.
Yeah. Flubber got like Titanic hit the iceberg of Flubber and sank Flubber. That's kind of awesome. And number one at the box office on my birthday. Well, you know what? I'm happy with this. It was a Ronnie Howard movie called Parenthood,
Wow.
which I watched recently a couple months ago.
Really?
At the behest of someone's passive recommendation. Well, actually, what it was someone, a new person, was talking to me. I'm like, oh yeah, Parenthood's this really good movie. And I was like, okay. And then I just rented it. as like, I'm connecting with you, right, by watching this. And now we're texting about it. Randy Newman's score is pretty good in this, huh? Blah, blah, blah. But a great movie. I love that movie. That was number one at the BO. Also, and then we're going to wrap up the birthday trivia portion of the podcast. I share a birthday with Saturday Night Live, 1975, October 11th,
Wow.
with Haley and Annie from The Parent Trap. Your birthday's October 11th. And I share the birthday of the marriage of Bill and Hillary Clinton, who got married on October 11th, 1978. I should know this by heart.
Wow. And I once played Hillary Clinton on TV.
Is that
Full
true?
circle. Yeah, for about 5 seconds. Yeah. I think she
Whoa.
was Hillary Rodham at the time. But yeah, I did about 5 seconds on a show called Gaslit that's about Watergate.
Oh my God, my friend Alyssa played a protester on that show,
Wow.
who then
So
shot a nasty look at Julia Roberts as she was being escorted out of the room by the
Oh.
cops. You played Hillary Clinton. Why is everyone in my like friend circle like, here's the historical character I played in Gaslit. Damn.
Damn,
How
that's
about that?
amazing. But she got to see Julia Roberts. The episode I was in was all about the security guard who overthrew everything, and that character was played by an amazing actor named Patrick Walker. But I did not get to meet any of the really big names.
Sure.
When I went to go to a fitting, I was leaving the huge costume room, and someone had written on masking tape, the show starred Sean Penn, over the door that in Sharpie that said, "Sean is always right." And it terrified me.
Dear Lord,
Yeah.
that's not
Ooh.
what you want to see. That's not the man. And it just feels to me, it feels so, and maybe that's my personality or being like stupid or whatever, but it feels so easy to go the exact opposite direction. Like I knew a couple of people that worked on Scandal, and they said Kerry Washington hangs out and will welcome guest stars when they're like, all right, here's your big scene and let's give it up for this person. And she's like camp counselor to everybody on that show.
Oh
And
my
then that attitude
gosh.
trickles down, which is why they all still seem obsessed with each other and talk on Zoom every 4 months for charity or something. It just feels easier to go that direction with it than the like Kerry Washington's always right. Writing that on her dressing room or something. Although with the young Hillary thing, I guess I could see it a little bit. What was your action in the episode? What'd you have to do?
The security guard is hanging out with a journalist, and the journalist brings him to this like hip DC bar. And so it's me and another guy who I forget what character he played, but also became like a senator later on. And we're talking about like there are lots of protests on the Hill going on. It was my second acting job ever. It was the same casting director that did Welcome to Flatch. And I think they were just like, we know someone who looks like tiny Hillary Clinton. And I did it, and it was super fun. And I did a lot of research beforehand because Hillary Clinton was an intern on the Hill and was transcribing the Watergate tapes was her job to go through and listen to all of them, which was so cool.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And then she would do her own Watergate with Benghazi, and we're here to
Yeah.
talk about that for the next 2 hours on the podcast. Again, I feel very deeply linked with Reagan, which is why I feel this way. Wow. Did you have
Really fun.
lines as Hillary? Did you have to do like a Hillary impression a little
I
bit or?
know I had to do something. I had to wave and I had to say something like, so the senator was saying like, we're doing all these protests, and I had to be like, that's important too. The
Whoa. Holy shit. It does make you want, in the vein of a young Sheldon, where is our Young Hillary series? When is that coming from Stars? And Stars is listening to this podcast, right?
Of course. Oh my
Okay.
gosh.
Good,
Hello.
good, good. Hello.
What's your story with Wayside School? How did this come into
Well,
your life?
this might be a little disappointing of a story, I
Go
think.
for it. Go
But
for
again, I want to underpromise here.
It's worked well so far.
I was homeschooled for most all of my education, except for 3 years, junior and senior year of high school, and then fourth grade. So in fourth grade, I went to Foster Elementary in the suburbs of Kingwood, Texas, just a little bit north of Houston. And they had a program. I'm sure you've had guests on that this is kind of their entry point to it. Although, by the way, I was like listening and checking out the past roster, and people did pick like books, like Pride and Prejudice. And I'm like, how about this dinky little
All are welcome. The next one after this is Macbeth. And the one before this was a book called Uglies that was, are you familiar with Uglies from 2005?
No, but I've seen the poster for the upcoming
Exactly.
adaptation. Yeah.
It's coming out in like 5 weeks. It's dystopian 300 years in the future. Everyone has to get plastic surgery at 16, so racism doesn't exist. If we all look the same.
This is kind of a base take. Wait a minute. Actually, I agree with the book.
Exactly.
Well, so at Foster Elementary, there was this program, and I'm going to struggle to remember some of the details of it. But in fourth grade, you go to the library and check out books. And then once you check them back in after having them loaned out, you could take a quiz afterward on the computer. And it was basically like a did you actually read this book sort of quiz. And based on your score of that and remembering things that happened in the book, you got points. And each book had a different point value. So something like this, or Hank the cow dog was on the lower end of the spectrum. Do we remember Hank?
I don't remember Hank. I'm so sorry.
Hank the cow dog that was then reborn as an audio drama series starring Matthew McConaughey as the titular Hank the cow dog, which I believe is available on some streaming podcast something. Not to plug the competition, I'm so sorry.
I'm ending the Zoom right now to go listen. Incredible.
Check into the Hank Bank. Almost did a legitimate spit take on Zoom. We were so close. So I remember getting the original Sideways Stories from Wayside School. I remember getting this one a little more vaguely because after the first one, I was like, oh, these are good. This is like funny. And so I'm like, whatever, 10, 11 years old at the time. And then in something that like maybe this actually would have been more interesting for me to talk about, maybe not, I did get Little Women because I was
Oh,
like, almost purely on the basis of, well, that's worth 36 points.
exactly. That's thick.
It was thick. And I'm not sure, you might know better off the top of your head. I'm not sure what the intended audience, like age range, was for Little Women. I don't know if it was for children, for young adults, for adults. I don't know.
It was a children's book. I mean, it was 1880s. I have no idea when it was published, but it was for kids. Kids in petticoats, yeah.
For little children and in petticoats, which we couldn't wear because it was too hot in Texas. Otherwise, I
Yeah.
would have. But I remember checking that out and then absolutely bombing the quiz because I was like, I don't know what this is. Like, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 years, maybe above what I was capable of reading at the time, maybe. Even though my mom says constantly, like, you read so much when you were a kid. I'm like, I read a little bit. I don't know if I
I
read
sure
so
had a
much.
lot of books, but I was not
Yeah.
reading.
I had a lot of books. I continue to have a lot of books here in the living room and on my bookshelf, and you're gesturing towards yours as well. So I remember I, for real, did read Little Women, but then just like bombed the comprehension test afterwards. Cut to 19 years later. It's my favorite movie of all time, the Greta Gerwig adaptation. I watched and I saw alone at the Pasadena ArcLight, and when it existed, RIP. The ArcLight was a chain that like a little bit more high-end prestige. They had an usher come out and intro the movie as if in the olden days, etc. And the guy came out at the 10:30 showing I was at and said, "Welcome to your private screening of Little Women." I was like, "Thanks." No one else was in the theater. I watched it one time, liked it a lot. I saw it again. I was like, "This is the best movie ever made." And then I saw it 9 more times. I think it's one of my most watched movies. And it's made me want to revisit it in book form, especially when Greta Gerwig's talking about, like, Louisa May Alcott's journey into all these characters was so fascinating to me when I. And I'm like, oh shit, I gotta read that. I've memorized the movie, basically, but I need to read the book. But anyway, I chose not to do that for this podcast.
I mean, saved me a lot of time, and I appreciate that. And
Sure.
you can always come back. There's a podcast, I think, called Joe's Boys that is going through that book chapter by chapter with various guests. And the host, I believe, is like a Alcott historian and
Oh.
is trans and talks about Alcott probably being trans. If you want to go down that rabbit hole, it's a really fascinating one to go down.
I've heard this read of it, and there's certainly enough in terms of how she described femininity that it is interesting to look at it through that lens.
Yeah.
But good to know that there's no shortage of content.
That film's incredible. That was the last movie I saw in theaters before the pandemic started.
Oh,
Yeah.
mine was Emma period,
Ooh.
as the Anya Taylor-Joy version.
We're in Sideways Side School. We're 30 floors up.
We are in a way that, like, what was your when you did? I listened to a little bit of it, but I didn't finish it. What was your take with your previous guest on the first book? Where did you both land on it?
We on in terms of required or not required, we said required except for the Eric's chapter
Okay.
because it was pretty fat phobic in one. Eric is fat and everyone talks about him as being the fat Eric and he doesn't like it, but we're still gonna keep calling him fat and his only character trait is gonna be that he's fat, which this book did not have. This book,
It does not.
it does not, which was nice. But it was cute. It was fun. I think it was, I had read that one when I was young, about fourth grade also. I had never read this one. I think it was interesting to see my guest for that episode was Jenny Cavallaro, who's a comedian, and talking about like looking for the origins of sort of our comedic lifestyle and where that started. And also the elements of how kind of sinister a lot of these stories could feel a little bit. There was always sort of an undercurrent. And I think Lewis Sacker, I mean, this is the third Sacker book I've done on this podcast. We also did Holes. He's a great author who like really clearly wants to delight his readers, which I think is so fun.
Yeah, he seems like a crowd pleaser kind of guy.
Absolutely.
And I haven't checked in with his latest work, which includes another entry into Wayside School that when I was reading up on it said it was influenced by the Trump presidency. And I'm like, what the hell?
Oh.
What is this book? Wayside School Beneath the Cloud of Doom.
Yeah.
Sacker explained the story was inspired by various factors in the modern world, including global warming, his mom's battle with Alzheimer's, and the election of Donald Trump. Now, this doesn't sound as silly as the
No.
book that we read.
No.
So it might be a slightly different flavor, but I think I resonate with what you and your last guest Jenny said. I think there was something about the specific flavor of silliness and almost like as far as like books go, and we were probably used to reading a little more eat your vegetables kind of books at the time. This felt like the primary aim was just a goof and
Yeah.
to delight, and there was something where it was like, oh, I didn't know you could do that in a book, and the rules were bendable and elastic and all these different kinds of ways. And I do wonder, like you were talking about the fatphobic stuff in the first one, I wonder if you've found people obviously like relitigate the Roald Dahl stuff so much as far as how across the board weird stuff there is and all
Yeah.
that. Is this just a function of children's literature at the time, or is it specific authors have specific vices as far as how they write and communicate?
I don't know, because in Holes, I mean, Sacker wrote the film of Holes also. He wrote the screenplay. And Holes, the only real difference between the book and the film is that the lead character Stanley is fat in the book. And by the end of the book, he's not, because he's been dehydrated at this work camp all summer and has been digging these holes. But there was no sort of like, there was no denigration in that. There was no sort of moral value put on it. Stanley was targeted for bullying, but I don't remember that it was necessarily based on his weight. It doesn't seem like something specific to Lewis at all. And the Erics are almost non-existent in this book.
I always just wonder, and it's so interesting when people try to contextualize of like, honestly, we know better than this now, and blah, blah, blah. Of just like, what was specific to what people, if it's just like, yeah, that's how people talked about everything then. And
Yeah.
then I don't know if y'all have ever discussed on the show, like what was the thing I saw where they put out new versions of the Roald Dahl books where
Ooh.
they took out all of the stuff that people might find objectionable down to like word choice. In a way where I'm like, gang, I don't know about this one. Like, it's almost like a parody of what the far
Yeah.
right like is afraid of. Like, we're sanitizing the books or, censorship, etc. That they're like the anti-censorship party is so funny
Yeah.
now. But
It
yeah,
is.
not we don't need to do that, I guess, with this book.
Well, I mean, no, it's just so odd at that point. I think it's like, there are other books, guys. There's so many books in
I
the
know.
world.
I don't, I really get frustrated at the project of, oh, is this offensive? We'll remove it. Sorry about that, guys. Like, I'm very pro contextualizing or disclaimers or putting in the historical, you know, basically making sure that people don't think certain books, movies, and TV shows just fell out of a coconut tree, but putting it in the context of everything that came before and that in which it lives, right? Instead of like, sorry, we're going to take all the blackface episodes of 30 Rock off, which was a lot, but I'm like, just put a thing on it.
The taking the Dungeons and Dragons community episode off,
Perfect example.
that's an odd one.
But all this to say, it's important to know and understand the history, and especially engaging with problematic art that obviously you wouldn't stand by today, or you wouldn't, you know, affirm today as being morally correct. I just feel like I don't know, and I hope this isn't too digressive, but it
Of
is
course.
interesting thinking about in context of like children's literature and stuff, and a lot of the stuff that we were raised on or grew up with, that there is this sort of are you on Letterboxd at all,
Of
Aaron?
course, of
Your
course.
posts on there? Do we follow each other on there?
I feel like maybe.
If we don't, let's remedy that soon. But anyway, something I've noticed is sort of a tick that a lot of my peers have on that platform, or even just in like everyday discourse and just like talking privately, is when you see something that has something that is egregious, racist, offensive, misogynist, homophobic, there is almost this necessity as a tick to identify it and then say, well, that didn't age well. Good movie. Could have done without this scene that was super problematic in such and such ways. And I just wonder what the value of that actually is beyond just the identification of like, Aaron, I'm kind of a good guy for noticing that, you know, the women were poorly written in this one. And now you're thinking and know and understand
He
I'm a pretty good
knows.
dude, for not for seeing like, you know, the women were not very well rounded and this male author, writer, whoever could have done a much better job. I just wonder what that is. If there is a way to engage with this stuff, or it's like, be that as it may, or take it as a given, or something. And not to say that people are not allowed to legitimately feel offended, but I think, do you identify, like, do you know what I'm talking about? Like that sort of, or it's almost like a little bit of housekeeping before I state my opinion on this, like XYZ, just
While we're
paying the
here, let's make
bills.
sure like we're all on the same page. And I'm thinking about like I've definitely done that. But why do we do that? Because I think for that movie, I was like really good until, and I wanted to remember the good parts.
I think it's like, and not to say virtue signal in the way that's like, again, so right-wing coded. But I do wonder if it's a little bit of that, or even maybe depending on the relationship, if it's to sort of form or identify trust of, don't worry, we're on the same page. I know and I understand this. But especially amongst close friends or people that you know on even like on any intimate level, it almost feels redundant to point that out. There are times when it's like, whoa, this is outrageous and shocking and interesting to try to understand why it was the way it was. And there's certainly stuff from the past, but I do wonder if there's like a sort of what C.S. Lewis once I defined as a chronological snobbery to this idea of doing that. And the way he used it, which was in a very different context, was, you know, the idea that we are assuming because this is the most recent time in history that we're living, that we are the most informed, the most sort of enlightened, and the most insightful that we can possibly be. The people that came before, not so much. They didn't have the tools. They didn't know what we know now. They didn't understand. But because it's 2024, as you and I are speaking, we get it in a way that no one else has ever gotten it. And I just wonder if all of this is an extension of that. Because obviously there will be things in a couple of years we'll be like, I can't believe I said that in 2024. Or thought about that. This sounds like, by the way, for your listeners, it's sounding like I'm like anti-cancel culture or something or whatever. But it's just, I think I'm just like trying to define this sort of for people that are probably like-minded like you and I,
Yeah.
almost like a subgenre of discussion that seems to be second nature for a lot of us and is ingrained after doing it for X amount of years. I think it's just interesting to interrogate like the value of and then what we're actually getting at when we get to those things. And if there's a way to do such things with like a little more curiosity rather than a binary of like, well, that sucked because of the, you know, and it sounds like the kind of conversations you're probably having on this show are very much like mixing it all together of like, what's the value here? What's the things that just kind of feel bad to read or understand? 'Cause it's just kind of it because those things are oftentimes legitimately jarring to experience, you know?
I think the sort of the most interesting one was on our Grapes of Wrath episode, because that book is so radical. John Steinbeck is such a radical like author, and coming up with all of these things about sort of overhauling massive systems that continue to perpetuate sort of systemic injustices. And then he'll say something really crazy about Native American people, and you'll sort of be like, you understand so much of this. Like, you understand this problem so deeply. So why does that stop right here? Why do we get, why do we get 90% of the way there, and then we can't get that last 10%?
That's so fascinating. Because again, that's another thing I feel like I notice or I'm guilty of doing myself of like, wow, it was pretty on point for 1952 or whatever, whenever the book or the media came out. And then trying to identify why there are certain like it precludes or it only goes so far up to a certain point and why that is. A book I've not read, but I have listened to the song The Ghost of Tom Joad by Bruce Springsteen a lot and seen it
Damn.
live a
I
lot. He loves playing it.
do remember loving your Instagram coverage of your last time seeing Bruce Springsteen live. I
Oh my
do remember
God.
that.
The one in Ireland?
Oh, maybe I thought it was at the bowl. No, because
The
you saw
Forum?
the Forum, because then you saw Bruce Springsteen, and then like the next day I went to the bowl to see the Jimmy Buffett tribute concert, which by
So,
the way was
yes.
my first concert.
That can't be true.
I went to a lot of community band concerts when I was young, because my parents, where they played like Star Spangled Banner. But no, I'd never been to a professional concert until
So
the
your first professional concert, like any of us, any of our first experience, it sort of colors what we expect from it. So in your head, well, I guess every concert, Harrison Ford's gonna come out and sing Margaritaville or whatever. The all-star Ed Paul McCartney was there. Whoa, what an experience.
And it was me and my boyfriend and my boyfriend's dad, who had had a colonoscopy that morning and was still a tiny bit drugged up. And so he was sort of
Oh
like
yeah.
very confused, but into it. And
Yeah,
just
for a
kind
dad to not go
of
completely stone cold sober, I would be like, is this real? Am I
Exactly.
dead?
Well, and my boyfriend and I don't drink. Everyone else there was absolutely plastered, to the
Oof.
point where the man who was about my He's not my father-in-law, but it's just the easiest way to say it. About his age, sitting in front of him, threw up into the woman in the next row's hair, was the kind of shenanigans was happening at the Jimmy Buffett concert. And because my father-in-law was a little medicated, he
Sure.
was starting to be like, "What happened? Did he just throw up in that woman's hair?" And we'd be like, "Yeah, he really did. He really did
Your
just throw
dad was
up."
seeing Jimmy Buffett by the end of that show. He's like, he's here, he's with us. Your father-in-law, excuse me. But that was the same week when Bruce played the Forum. So I saw him twice there, and then I went to Ireland to see him two more times a couple of months ago. And he played Tom Joad.
Incredible.
He played Tom Joad with Tom Morello at one of those Forum shows, which has made me want to watch the movie at least.
The book is incredible. It really is incredible. And for being that thick, there's very few pages wasted, which is
Wow.
impressive. And I think what's fun with that book, and I'm going to loop it back around, is the way that it kind of plays with form. You'll have these in narrative chapters and then these out of narrative chapters that give you really broad views of, like, there's a chapter that's all from the perspective of like a used car salesman trying to sell cars to people traveling west. And I think something that I know in our last episode, Jenny really loved about Wayside and continues in this book, is how they play with form. Like in the first one, there's no 19th story because there's no 19th story in the building. And in this book, which was really fun, we get to go to the 19th story and go to that classroom with
That
Miss
freaks me
Zarvis.
out.
That was frightening. And when I think Myron goes to the basement was really frightening.
Oh
In the
yeah.
beginning of Wayside School, the first book, their teacher, Mrs. Gorf, dies
Gorf.
immediately. Gorf is eaten by the author as an apple.
Yeah.
And then her shadow is looming in this book. She's in the basement. No one go to the basement. I was always very frightened of our basement when I was very young.
Where'd you grow up?
Right outside DC in Maryland.
Okay, see, we didn't really. My memory of Texas is we did not have basements.
Yeah, I miss basements, especially in the summer. There's just something very like tranquil about going to the basement to cool down in the
Oh,
summer.
yeah. No, it's a little shelter from the heat and the storm out there.
Exactly.
But I was robbed of that experience growing up in Texas.
And they don't have them here in California.
No, so I moved to another state where it's like no basements for you. So I gotta go to the Midwest or somewhere. But I will say, to relate it back too, I came out through a program through University of Texas called UT in LA, and it was kind of a satellite school thing where you could take classes out here and do internships and stuff. And we stayed at what was called at the time the Oakwood Apartments. It's the apartment complex across the street from the Warner Brothers lot, which there's been many documentaries made about, and like all the weird kind of darkness and tragedy and stuff that's happened. Happened there. And at UT, before that semester, I remember taking a children's literature class
Ooh.
for one semester, which was so fun to engage with it from like literally an academic perspective. It was also the first time I ever read any of the Harry Potter books was in
Ooh.
college. So I blazed through those suckers in a couple of months, I guess. But it really gave me a big respect and reappreciation for that genre. In particular, and how hard it's not just like, oh yeah, kids like anything, blah blah blah, here's a bunch of bullshit, whatever. Like there's so much craft and care that's to be put into it that is actually difficult to do thoughtfully and to do well, like they do in this book. And honestly, like as you were talking about comic sensibilities and how this shaped it, there's so much about the non sequitur nature of this book that almost, even though it was many, many years ago, I do wonder if it set me up for an attention span of, is this why I liked Family Guy in middle school and high school? Because these are all basically cutaways, and some of them sort of intersect a little bit. There's some continuum of narrative, but overall, it's just like, here's a gag or an idea, and then let's get out of here. Here's an idea, here's a pun, let's get out of here. You know, and
Yeah.
him executing those things.
Which is interesting because I think I am sort of on the opposite side of like, I'm generally turned off by short story collections unless they have that sort of interweaving plot. So I think when I read the first one, I was like, this is nice and fun, but I want something longer. I want something broader that connects. And I think this one is fun because you get the same characters to carry over. I didn't know going into it that that would be the case. I thought maybe we're getting all new characters, that some of the storylines are continued in terms of like Miss Zarvis and Miss Gorf, and the characters are still dealing with like Todd is always getting sent home early and things like that. And so I think something that was exciting about this one was seeing how the world expands. Like, we've got all our characters, we know where we are, we know the world. Let's sort of play with what's going on in the cafeteria today, and what's going on in the basement, and what's going on. I don't think we really got a lot with the principal in the first book, and there's some mysteries to work out here, which is fun.
It did blow my mind. I remember even reading that first one where it's like, wait, BB gun? That's the funniest thing I've ever heard. I get it. And fourth grade me is just like doing cartwheels, feeling so funny. I have a great sense of humor for it. But yeah, we get into like almost something resembling the mythology of the school. And I do wonder how much that continues. Or if like BB Gun grows up and and votes for Trump in the
I
latest.
mean, well, she BB Gunn was interesting because she makes up a little brother who is writing mean things on all of her homework, which I was going through my like highlights in the ebook just before this, and there was a joke that again was like, oh, that's my sensibility, where there's something written on BB's homework that's like, Mrs. Jewel smells bad or something. And BB goes, that's not true. I love how you smell. And then they went on to the next thing and the story moved forward, and that sort of joke is just left there. And I was like, that's something I'm gonna write like in an hour
Oh,
for
yeah.
whatever I'm working on. But what I also loved is something I've been thinking a lot about. I really liked lying when I was about this age.
Really? Speak on
Yeah.
that.
So in the book, BB makes up a little brother who's writing bad things on all her homework, and then we end up going to the classroom that doesn't exist, and the brother that doesn't exist is there, and that is skin crawling. It's a little tingly moment. Yeah, I just think I thought I was not an interesting person. So I made up lies to be interesting. Like, I moved schools between second and third grade, and I didn't have any friends. So in third grade, I was like, well, at my old school, I had these friends, and they were named Billy and Mandy. And everyone goes, like, the show, like the cartoon that's on right now about Billy and Mandy. And I go, no, completely different, obviously. Then I went to a different school, and I in order to be interesting, I made up a story that I had been bullied because of my last name. And they said, okay, well, what did they say about your last name? Because my last name is Bowles. And I couldn't come up with something. So I was like, they called me Spoon in Bowles.
A withering insult from a child to be called
It
spoon and bowls.
was so bad. And those are the two big ones that I remember. But yeah, I think I felt very dull and I wanted to be special.
Yeah, and narrative invention is a shortcut to that being the case, to being interesting. I was afraid of lying when I was a kid. I mean, I certainly did it a couple of times, I can recall, but it was not fun for me. It would produce more anxiety. I'm like, I'm not gonna get away with this.
And you were also homeschooled, so the world is smaller, fewer people
Yeah,
to lie to.
lie to my mom. She's gonna smell it. She's gonna know what's going on. Yeah. It was literally smaller. You're right. Which I wonder if that means like there was less example or model of me for the positive benefits or results of lying well. Like what you did with Mandy and Bandy or whatever your friends were called.
But I did love a lie. For some reason, that has been bubbling up in my memory a lot lately. And also around second grade, there was a phase where I just kept the only time my parents ever really had like a sit down intervention with me. Second grade, they're like, Erin, you have to stop putting stuff in your mouth.
Do
Stop
you see
it.
these behaviors related or correlated in any way? The lying and the oral stuff?
Maybe. I mean, the lying was right after.
Yeah.
And the lying was right after a move, and the oral stuff was right before. So
Okay.
maybe.
You just wanted to be seen. You
Exactly.
just wanted to be understood.
I know. It's the curse of being a wallflower.
Okay, not the perk, but a curse.
I know.
You accept the lies you think you believe, or whatever.
Sure.
I remember seeing it 11 years ago and being like, this movie's great.
I read it and I cried. I have sort of been surprised no one's asked to do it on this show, but I also vaguely remember it's about sexual abuse, and I'm sort of thankful for that it hasn't come up yet.
Yeah, you
I'll
want to
do
talk about
it.
that for an hour and a half on your show? I mean, the thing that has aged well is I do think about we accept the love we think we deserve.
Oh.
Not infrequently, even in my adult life, talking to other people in their 30s, navigating their relationships, it may not be more complicated than that.
It stuck for a reason. It
Oh,
is a
yeah.
nugget of wisdom.
Yeah, which is annoying, but it's true. It might be true.
Yeah. I mean, the end is the title of the book, Wayside School is Falling Down. Wayside School does not fall down. Rather, it is flooded with cows, as
Yeah.
in the
Which we all
fruit.
saw coming, which
We
we
all
could
saw
all
the
predict.
pilot of Bob's Burgers. We know they
Yeah.
can't go downstairs. And so the school is stuck. Flooded with cows. Lewis by himself is in there trying to get them out. And we don't know what happens to Wayside School, I think.
Well, in the new book, the cows do end up going to a MAGA rally, unfortunately.
Oh
It's
no.
sad.
God,
They're
what
like,
were Trump's policies on agriculture? I don't even know.
they're MUGA. They're not
No,
MAGA.
Kevin, get
They're
out.
MUGA. They're MUGA.
But speaking of another formative childhood text,
Yeah.
click clack moo, cows that type. Are you familiar with this picture book?
No, but let me Google it to see if I am.
I
No,
think
this missed me.
classic that I got it. It's about cows that unionize because they want electric blankets.
Whoa.
They get a typewriter and they start making demands.
They believe in unions? Holy shit.
Yeah.
That's kind of awesome.
It was a thing that when the strike happened last year, I was sort of like, yeah, of course I'm standing with my union. I'm primed for this.
Yeah,
I
for
was raised
years, for
with this
generations.
title.
Click, clack, moo, don't replace us with AI. That's
Exactly.
what your sign said on the picket lines.
And I was alarmed. There's a few like very big, again, like nuggets of wisdom in this book. Because in the first one, the chapter that I had remembered best was Jenny shows up for school and no one's there. There are these guys with like briefcases who are from like the government, and the reveal is that it's Saturday, and that's why no one else is at school.
We get the briefcase gang again in this
Yes,
one.
when Myron goes down to the basement and they start saying like, what are you doing out of your cage? I mean, seat. And Myron goes, I just want to be free. And then the bald man says, well, do you want to be free or do you want to be safe?
There's a lot there.
You can't have it both ways. And then he starts talking, you'll have to brush your teeth. You won't be allowed to watch TV until you finish your homework. Then Myron says, I want to be free. And the man with the attaché case makes him sign it, but it's in a foreign language, but he signs and then he leaves. And he gets up to the classroom. Mrs. Jules makes him write his name on the board for discipline, and he doesn't. And he just sits on the floor, doesn't follow the rules, and there's nothing Miss Jules can do. But final line, when Myron goes to the basement, he loses his shoe. After school, Miss Jules found Myron's other sneaker in the teacher's arms in the refrigerator, which out of context does not sound like much, but was harrowing when I read it yesterday.
Yeah, what did you take that to mean? Because I was a little puzzled by that.
Yeah, I mean, we've got the ghost of Miss Gorf running about. So I connected it to that. I don't think I thought a lot more of it than that, but I think it was this very odd moment of Lewis sort of again with a click clack moo cows at type saying that all these rules are kind of made up. And I mean, certainly there are things that Mrs. Jules can do. We get the principle later. There's something disarming about these books, partly in the humor, but then also Lewis like will lay down this really complex question and then kind of say, that's all.
Do with that what you will. I
Yeah.
know that's the nature of the sort of non sequiturness of it. There's not a lot of through lines thematically. It's just like a lot of different kinds of ideas and little character sketches, like, what if this happened? Okay, gotta go, you know.
Yeah. Do we pull out any themes from this, really?
School's crazy, guys. School's
Which is
freaking
true.
crazy. Maybe, like, there's certain parts of the educational system that are arbitrary. He seems to, like, zero in on, oh, the teacher's just making them do busy work. They're not really teaching. Like, in certain parts,
That's
you
true.
can.
Busy work comes up several times. Yeah.
So you do, and that was a talking point I remember from my childhood as well. It's like, oh, public school, it's just a lot of busy work. You're just kind of, which I don't know what their version of busy work was or what they were envisioning happened at a public school, but that was sort of the rebuttal
Yeah.
against maybe engaging with going to it too much,
Yeah.
which I find fascinating, this idea of busy work.
Yeah. I know Lewis was the yard teacher at a school. I know when he was in college, he took a course. He like took a volunteer course in order to get out of like a harder credit. And the volunteering ended up being like as a playground monitor. And then a lot of the characters were inspired by kids he met. But I don't know. I'm sort of fascinated by why certain authors get drawn to this genre and this audience. And I think for some people, there's like really clear explanations for it. And sometimes there isn't.
Yeah, well, I was looking a little bit up on him. He is younger than I thought he would be. He is only 70 years old, which is 11 years younger than our current president, which is how I measure all age now.
Which is fair.
It's like, can they do the job? I don't know. Are they younger than the president? Sure, why not? Which means that Sideways Stories came out, the first one came out when he was 24 years old.
Yeah.
He was a younger man.
Yeah. And then this was 11 years later after the first one. It's a big time gap there.
And I'm just wondering, like, what specifically, what, I don't know what all his education was. I assume he probably went to college. Yeah, he
I
went to
think,
UC
yeah.
Berkeley. So he's writing this stuff like 2 years out of education or starting to and reflecting on it. And if it was, I'm sure he's given some sort of like expositional interview of like, well, what drew me to it was the mundanity and the silliness of it. I just, or maybe it's just
Yeah.
like, I got a case of the sillies and I just wanted
Yeah, I mean, I know he was working at a sweater factory in Connecticut
to.
and writing at least the first Wayside at night. And I know he got fired from the Connecticut sweater factory. Don't
For
know why.
doing what?
I don't know.
He let a cow in there to make the sweaters?
I mean, probably.
Damn. And he's still, yeah, the last Sideways Stories was his last book in 2020, it looks like.
Yeah,
So
maybe his pandemic project.
he's not totally retired, I guess.
What was his last before that? Do you know? Can you find?
It was a book called Fuzzy Mud, of
Of
course.
course.
All the children can't stop talking about Fuzzy
Fuzzy
Mud.
mud. Yeah, it's odd to see like what really hits and what doesn't.
As far as his stuff goes, you mean?
Or just in general, like the second book we ever did on the show was A Bad Case of Stripes, which was a big hit. And the same year it came out, the author, who I don't remember his name, had, well, his first name is David, had another huge book that year called No David. That was, I remember the illustrations from that really clearly. It might have been A Beat After You, but he had these two like huge smash hits in 1 year. And it's just a whole industry that I'm very fascinated by.
Yeah, and especially the economics of how it works now. If it's just like all of publishing and if they all just sell significantly fewer now than they used to, what is the State of the Union of the Scholastic Book Fair? Does that still occur in America?
Within the last few months, I saw a truck on the highway that was on the side was a Scholastic Book Fair
Okay,
truck.
so it's still going. The truck is still going.
Maybe it's like a
Maybe.
mobile.
Maybe, yeah,
Yeah.
it's a road show where it's like, come in the truck. That's where the fair is.
Exactly. I'd do that.
Yeah, I would do it
Yeah.
too.
I really hope the kids these days still have Scholastic Book Fairs. There's just something about it.
There's no way to know unless we talk to one. And I think you should have a child on your show.
I should.
I think it would be really fun. I would listen to
Child
it. Like that.
podcasting.
What? Children talking to each other? Like there was a podcast I used to listen to that was hosted by like a 7-year-old.
Hell yeah.
And it was interesting, like, oh, he's not a bad interviewer. He's pretty good.
It
It's possible.
is. One of the other big narratives across the board in this book is Mark Miller slash Benjamin Nushmut, who is a
Yes.
new kid. His real name is Benjamin. Miss Jules calls him Mark Miller, and he can't get up the nerve to correct her.
That's right.
Didn't do much for me. What about you?
You know, it kind of evoked a Don Draper-esque meditation
Oh.
on identity and who we are, the names we give ourselves versus the names others bestow upon us. But no, it absolutely did nothing for me as well. I couldn't connect with it.
Like I've had issues telling teachers things, surely,
Well, the
but
spoon in the bowl alone, I
I
would
mean,
be triggered by that for the rest of my life. Be very sensitive.
yeah, the that was so silly. At least my lies have gotten better, hopefully.
Is that the hope? Is that the lies get
Yeah, now I'm
better over
wondering.
time?
No, I think maybe the hope is that I lie less, which I think is true, or that all the lies are fiction for profit.
Silly lies.
Yeah, acting is a lie.
Not big little lies.
Man, may we all be so lucky to be on Big Little Lies.
May we all be. You could play young Hillary Clinton. When is Hillary Clinton going to join the cast of Big Little Lies? It's like the fourth housewife in Malibu.
Yeah. There's a line where Sweet DJ just says, time isn't real.
That's the funny thing about setting stories in this very goofy world is that it is hard to depend on. I'm sure like the idea behind it is, well, it's like the relational context, the substance of that is like what you're supposed to hook into. But then there is almost like revisiting it as an adult, there's this almost like stakelessness to, well, yeah, nothing kind of means anything, and then this is gonna happen, the school blew up, just kidding. It's not like it can feel like that in a way that's hard to invest, maybe in a deeper level in it. I'm not sure.
Definitely. Someone brings a hobo for show and tell. I highlighted that because hobo and homelessness was like a tremendous joke when I was younger, which is odd now.
Yeah. Well, even hobo as like a fixture of child's imagery. There was just a lot of hobo stuff. There was cartoons about hobos. There was like the bindle and the sack over the shoulder. It was just sort of which almost feels like very American in nature, is to normalize like, yeah, like this isn't gonna get fixed anytime soon.
No, so let's like mythologize it, let's put it in a
Kind of,
little
it makes
bit.
it a little bit softer, right?
Yeah, there is a moment later on where someone is like, it's weird that you brought a homeless person to show and tell. They're a person. And I appreciated that. But yeah, I think that's I don't come to that with attitude of like, we were so crazy back then, or cancel culture of just like, that's odd, isn't it? That's odd.
It's strange. I think you would be less likely to find something like that now. That's what's the interesting part of it, is just this window in time of like, why was it so like, oh yeah, hobos were just sort of like, I don't even know what an equivocal image would be in the 21st century as to something that's a little whimsical and almost carnival coded. And I'm sure there are people that have done comprehensive explainers about, oh, it was tied to this in the Depression era, and then it stuck around, and it's associated with like the clown and XYZ. But yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe it is like just talking it out, like, is it because it's like the cousin to the clown as an archetype, and the clown is so children's entertainment coded, Bozo the Clown and all that stuff. Maybe that's a part of it. It felt like accessible and not scary for that to be a part of children's entertainment.
Which is odd growing up in such an era of like stranger danger that the sort of whimsical hobo could also exist.
Oh yeah, but listen, life is full of contradictions.
Ain't it just? How did it feel coming back to this? How has your sort of view of Wayside changed?
I think it is not as foundational of a text of my sense of humor. Because the thing I really remember being struck by when I was a child was, wow, I'm reading this book so fast. Because I read, but I just didn't read that fast. And as it is today, it just took me a lot to finish a thing. And there was something about the super accessible nature of it, how readable it was. I feel like that's an interesting experience for children to. Like not to just use 1,000 words to say reading is fun, isn't that weird? But to have a visceral experience of this feels easy, this feels like it's just flowing through me, and revisiting it as a hopefully fully formed adult, it felt less like that. It didn't feel as like wow, to get back into it. Certain parts of it remained very charming, but perhaps less so than they had been.
Yeah, there are a few little gems. There's some anecdote where a girl is always laughing too loud at stories or crying too much at stories, and Miss Jewel says, like, no, I love that you do that. It makes it more fun for me and it's
I thought that was
affirming.
very nice. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was a really sweet moment. I think it's like my last highlight. There's a moment, I don't even remember what this is about. The chapter is called Love and a Dead Rat, but it says, when I give my love to someone, I end up with more love than I started with. The more love you give away, the more you have left, which I thought was gorgeous.
That's one of those we accept the love we think we deserve, where it's like, you know what? That deserves a little sticking power.
Exactly. And then Damon says, I love you, Miss Jules. Miss Jules says, I love you, Damon. And then a dead rat says, this is getting disgusting, and left the room. And I love that button. I do love that button.
That was a funny joke. Like anytime an animal is like, oh boy, I will to the day I die think that's funny.
Yeah.
When I was like, well, no, thank you.
Exactly. And especially when it's like when it changes the rules. We didn't know this rat could talk.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah. Would you consider it required reading?
I would not consider it required reading.
I agree.
It's falling a little bit short,
Yeah.
I think, of what is required.
And that's okay. Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's worthless. Doesn't mean it's not without merit,
It's just not
but
required.
it's not what I would, if I was a father right now. It's not, and I took my kid to the Scholastic Book Fair. I wouldn't be like, honey, honey, you gotta go get the Wayside Stories about global warming or whatever it's about now.
I love Lewis. I'm not going to crack that one open. Well, that's all I've got. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. What a delight to talk with you. How
Is there
fun.
anything you'd like to plug as we round out?
Just listen to Good Christian Fun wherever you get podcasts, a show in which we also sort of revisit culture from our past and youth and see how it holds up for those of us with a little bit of religion in our childhoods. And
Oh,
turns out a lot of it's bad. Some of it's good, but most of it's bad.
Well, I'll leave it at that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Kevin. Check out Good Christian Fun. Our next episode, big turn, big pivot. We're doing Macbeth. Oh, it's gonna be good. All right. And no one affiliated with this podcast is affiliated with this movie, but the new Alien movie comes out this Friday. I am excited. It is a perfect franchise where you have like two spectacular films, two horrible films, and then two. I can't speak on their merit, but I really like the prequels. I really like the prequels. And Ridley Scott, what do you do and listen to this podcast? Oh my gosh, thanks for being here. Okay, you can support the podcast at buymeacoffee.com/required reading. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little note and some bookmarks for the show. You can find me everywhere at Aaron R. Bowles. The R stands for rhinoplasty. Have I done that? Have I said that one already? Oh my God.